Here in NBC's newsroom in New York is John Gunther, noted correspondent and author of Inside Asia and Inside Europe. Before hearing from Mr. Gunther, Philip McKenzie, NBC's war reporter in Italy, is standing by in the Italian capital waiting to speak to you. So go ahead, Rome.
Hello, National Broadcasting Company. This is Philip R. McKenzie calling from Rome, Italy. May the 9th is the anniversary of the Italian conquest of Abyssinia in 1936, and consequently of the foundation of the Italian Empire. But this date has also been chosen for Army Day. It is therefore a red-letter day, and as such, it has been celebrated throughout the country, special significance being attached to it this year. Early this morning, detachments representing all the branches of the armed forces, the army naturally predominating, marched to Piazza Venezia in front of the imposing monument to Victor Emmanuel, the first king of United Italy, which is also the tomb of the unknown warrior. All the fascist organizations, men, women, and children, were present, but the members of the fascist party who belonged to the army replaced their black shirts with a military uniform in honor of the occasion. The Duce, wearing the uniform of First Field Marshal of Italy, came out of the Palazzo Venezia accompanied by the Chief of Staff and the other Secretary of State for War, and he walked up the stairway while the troops presented arms. Here, he conferred 37 gold and 15 silver medals for valor to the memory of officers and men who were killed in action in Abyssinia, Spain, and Albania. And he pinned the decorations on the breast of their next of kin, mothers, wives, and children. Then the Duce took the salute while the troops marched past and were withdrawn from the square, which was invaded by masses of people. There were loud and prolonged cheers and acclamations, which were increased when the Duce appeared in the balcony of Palazzo Venezia. The people insisted that he should make a speech, and he finally consented to say a few words. He said, "The date of May the 9th, 1936, marks the great day in the history of the country, the day of a glorious victory. After my speeches, you must be get accustomed to my silences, which will be broken only by acts." Enthusiastic cheers and applause greeted the Duce's words, which brought the ceremony to an end. Last year, speaking at Cuneo, the Duce said that he would not make further speeches, and he has kept his word, as since that day he has been practically silent. In fact, speeches were unnecessary to define Italy's policy and attitude, because it is well known that she will enter the war when her interests are threatened. The Duce alone will decide when the right moment for her intervention has arrived. His political foresight has never proved wrong, and this is undoubtedly one of the great assets in a country where everybody has a blind faith in the luck of the moment. What this moment holds, only one man can know. And the nation, which is fully prepared for war, is accordingly waiting without impatience and without excitement. It is fully realized here that this is a war of the unexpected, and that the present uncertainty is being increased by wild speculations and liquid-wide conjectures. Although Italy has so far kept out of the war, it does not follow that she will not enter it, the more so as her participation in its final settlement is certain and inevitable. What everybody wants to know now is whether Italy's intervention is imminent or remote. The Duce's speech, which is certainly to the point, does not afford any indication towards the answer of such a question. It leaves no room to justify any prediction, and it is so clear that any attempt at interpretation is useless. It may be assumed that until he breaks his self-imposed silence, the situation, however tense and ominous it may appear, is still unchanged. It must be admitted, however, and this must be taken as a reassuring sign, that while other countries, also outside the war, are feverishly hastening preparations for their defense, and their people are excited and anxious, in Italy, one sees the striking contrast that everything is calm and quiet. The people are convinced that the country's preparations for war are efficient and complete, and that all possible measures have been taken. Consequently, a national holiday like May the 9th is spent in patriotic commemoration, while the king in Rome, while the king at Naples, inaugurates the first exposition of Italy's territories overseas. This is a fact which, although not of a sensational character, similar to the rapidly moving events prevalent nowadays, should not be lost sight of. I now return you to the National Broadcasting Company.
We are back in New York, and here is John Gunther.
Good evening, everybody. If anyone a year ago had said that a German invasion of Great Britain was even a remote possibility, we would have summoned a psychiatrist. And today, a German invasion of Great Britain is still hardly more than a remote possibility. Yet it is being talked about. In his speech last week, Mr. Chamberlain said that a lightning swoop by the Nazis on British soil was not excluded. Today we have several small items of news in this direction. I don't mean to exaggerate, but Sir John Anderson, the British minister in charge of home security, has introduced new legislation against fifth columnism in England, with severe penalties for sabotage. It's reported that British soldiers are being instructed to watch out for parachute troops that might be dropped on British soil by the enemy, and that guards at all British aerodromes are to be drilled in pistol practice. Above all, there's a line in Mr. Churchill's speech that seems to carry hidden significance. Now I know that Mr. Churchill is often given to rhetoric. On the other hand, when he spoke yesterday, he was weighing every word. He knew the considerable importance of the occasion. He said, quote, "At no time in the last war were we in greater peril than we are now," unquote. Well, among a great many other things, Mr. Churchill is a historian, aside from being a watercolor painter, a bricklayer, a lecturer, and so on. Also, at those times in the last war, when he wasn't actually in the ring, he saw it from a ringside seat. We have to assume that this sentence was written by a man who knows what did happen in the last war and what is happening now. And Mr. Churchill says that at no time in the last war was Great Britain in greater peril than today. The greatest peril that Britain faced in the last war was the breakthrough of the Germans in March 1918, when General Gough's Fifth Army was destroyed, when it seemed that the Germans would capture Paris, defeat the Allies, and win the war. And that moment was a very grim and black moment. Now, Mr. Churchill indicates, things may be even worse. One can only conclude that English leaders think there's a possibility, at least, that Great Britain may be attacked more drastically than she was ever attacked in the last Great War. And it's not a comforting thought from the Allied point of view. This note of grave danger is reinforced by news from England tonight that the British are calling 2.5 million more men to the colors. This will mean mobilization of all men in England from the ages of 19 to 37. Meantime, it's clear that a full-fledged cabinet crisis is in process in England. The Commons recess today until May 21st. It may reconvene if events are pressing. Mr. Chamberlain's government is slipping fast, even though it won another vote tonight when a Labour motion to summon the Commons a week earlier, on May 14th, was defeated. It isn't so surprising, as the British see it, that Mr. Chamberlain hasn't yet resigned. First of all, the dominant note in his character is, I should say, stubbornness. He's a most exceptionally tenacious old man. Second, the British do things like this very slowly, deliberately. It's a serious matter to change a government in England. The dynamics of warfare, demand change. The passive prime minister who begins a war is almost always replaced sooner or later by a more active, more aggressive figure. In 1916, Mr. Asquith gave way to Mr. Lloyd George, but it took some time to get Asquith out. That crisis, as I remember, lasted almost 2 weeks. But third, and the chief reason, I think, why Mr. Chamberlain hasn't resigned yet is the question, who is going to replace him? Who is the inevitable man? And the answer might seem to be Mr. Churchill, but it isn't absolutely sure. Many good observers in Great Britain think that Lord Halifax, the present Foreign Secretary, has at least as good a chance for the succession as Churchill. After all, Churchill is violently disliked by many members of the Tory party, and it's doubtful if Labour would join a Churchill coalition. Halifax is a much milder man, much more middle-of-the-roadish. The obstacle to Halifax is that he's a lord and sits in the House of Lords. But the British Constitution, as you know, is very flexible, and it's only a tradition, a comparatively recent tradition, not a law, that the Prime Minister must be a commoner. Today there was talk of a joint resolution by both houses which would enable Halifax, though a lord, to sit in the Commons. Another possibility is that Halifax might be titular Prime Minister in the Lords, with Churchill deputizing for him in the lower house. To recapitulate, it can't be forecast absolutely that Mr. Chamberlain is going to resign today or tomorrow, but it can be stated with the utmost assurance that he must drastically recast and reconstitute his government. Even the London Times, which always supports the cabinet in office, demands this. Mr. Chamberlain may save his own scalp for a while, but some other heads are going to fall. It's quite possible that during the recess, Chamberlain will make a technical resignation, which may enable him to resume office, for the time being anyway, with a new team. Today, Chamberlain consulted with Attlee and Greenwood of the Labour Party. The presumption is that he invited them to join a national coalition. The report is that they turned him down. The Labour Party cannot finally decide whether or not to join a Conservative coalition until Monday, when their national executive concludes its examination of this problem. If Labour refuses to work with Chamberlain, then he's probably doomed, which is an odd enough point that the Labour Party, which he has always more or less detested, holds him in its power. Whatever new government is formed, its task is going to be very obvious and very onerous, namely to get on with the job to checkmate the Germans somewhere to try to win the war. And now here again I must refer to the Churchill speech. It was a profoundly interesting speech. When Winston talks, he does say something. You can't deny that. The most important thing he said was that air power has decisively affected the movements of fleets and armies. He admitted quite candidly that Great Britain is inferior to Germany in air power, and he added that this inferiority will condemn the British for some time to come to a great deal of difficulty. This last sentence is a direct quote. This means, in effect, if you read between the lines, that the British must rest content to fight a defensive war for some time, that the initiative remains with the Germans, that a new German offensive may be anticipated almost any time, almost anywhere. Obviously, now that Mr. Churchill has admitted this, though the Germans know it already, they may proceed to act. They will act while their superiority in the air is so massive. They'll act before the British and the French catch up. From this angle, this general question of air superiority, I think the most significant foreign story in the news tonight is a Washington story, if that isn't a paradox. The British have been making comparatively few purchases of airplanes in the United States in the past months. And this is rather puzzling. A dispatch from Washington tonight says that the Allied purchasing mission here planned to spend approximately $1 billion for the purchase of 8,000 planes. Yet so far, they've only bought 1,900. Our newest military models are now available, and the British still have enough cash to buy them. But they're proceeding very slowly, and apparently they're planning to buy not fighters, but mostly bombers. This would indicate that they're still thinking predominantly in defensive terms for a long time in future. No one can fairly criticize the British for not buying our planes if they don't want them. But it's stated that joint Anglo-French production of aircraft is still only a bit over 1,200 planes a month, whereas the Germans are producing almost 3,000 planes a month. Now, this is the question, the sort of question that derives naturally out of Mr. Churchill's speech, and that any new British government must grimly face. After all, as Lloyd George pointed out, the British began a serious rearmament program back in 1935 with $7.5 billion to spend. What's happened to all this money? Why are the British still so far behind? The other big item in the news tonight is the announcement that the German army has taken over the German railways for this weekend. This doesn't necessarily mean anything sensational. It may presage a sudden German attack in the direction of Holland or the Balkans. On the face of available information, it looks more like a routine measure. This weekend, all over Europe, is Whitsun, which most Europeans take almost as seriously as Easter or Christmas. It's the country-going weekend par excellence. Presumably, we don't yet know, the Germans don't want to risk any civilian congestion on their lines. Now, in reference to the British cabinet crisis, here is a flash that has just come in from London by the AP that the lobby correspondent of Reuters, the British news agency, said in a midnight review of the government crisis that Chamberlain's departure is almost certain. Good night.
Thank you, John Gunther. Mr. Gunther will be heard again over most of these stations at 8:15 Eastern Daylight Time Saturday evening. This has been a Blue Network presentation of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.